Episode 15, Understanding Our Emotions. Rethinking the Bible with Jack Pelham. Welcome to Rethinking the Bible. This is an audio podcast where we apply reality-based thinking to interpreting the Bible. Reality-based thinking is my name for a philosophy that seeks to make constant use of honesty, rationality, and responsibility in seeking out the reality of things while trying to avoid common errors. And for the record, I define reality as the state of things as they actually exist, as opposed to one's perceptions, beliefs, or wishes about them. And you should know, this is a serial podcast, so it's best if you start from episode 1 and work your way forward from there, because we lay some foundational principles up front, and you'll be lost later if you skip them now. Well, welcome back. This is episode 15, and I wanted to talk today about understanding our emotions. And we'll get into that in just a minute, but I thought I would follow up a little bit from episodes 13 and 14, where I talked off the script, and we got some very useful feedback from a couple of our listeners. We really appreciate that. It's good to know how people take it. Some thought that it was, in one sense, more conversational, and it was more winsome and easier to relate to, where the reading the script tends to be a bit more formal, a little harder to hook into for some, and so forth. Also, some said that the new, the scriptless one can be a little harder to follow, to keep up with than the scripted. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag, actually. However, the unscripted is so much faster to produce, and so it leaves me sort of in the balance wondering, should I get a lot of information out, you know, a lot of content published sooner than later, or should I find a way to make the written script sound even more spontaneous and such. One person said that it might come across, the scripted might come across as being more, I forget the exact word, severe or harsh than it is intended. Well, I can guarantee that that's true. I don't feel the need to be harsh with anybody. I'm not the boss of you. I'm just another person trying to work the puzzle, trying to understand what time it is here in the world. And so I think I will give it a try for some time, going without a script, which is interesting. Just this morning, I was writing some notes about this episode you're about to hear today, and I noticed that Jack has a hard time writing notes without it quickly turning into a full through composed essay, because it's just so easy for me to write, you know, type, 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 and I think it, and it comes out on the page, and well, wait a minute, if these are just notes, how come I'm writing full paragraphs? So that's funny, the struggles that it takes just to figure out how best to communicate these messages to lots of people at one time. I think it would be a lot easier if everyone would just become like me in every respect and all your dispositions and your personality, and then you could take it like I put it out, and everybody would understand me exactly. So I don't think that's going to happen. So I hope that you will continue to be patient as we figure out the fine-tuning on the format and the nature of the content here. So getting back to where I'm headed, I would love to talk about lots and lots of things on this podcast series in general. I want to talk about, okay, let's use some scholar words here. So you can go ahead and make your eyes roll back in your head or make them glass over. I want to talk about soteriology, which is salvation talk. I want to talk about ecclesiology, which is how the church is supposed to be designed and run and what that was all about. I want to talk about eschatology, you know, end times business and what all was meant by that. I'd like to talk about origins and cosmology, you know, the meaning biblical cosmology, Genesis 1, you know, what was created, what did all that mean, all this, you know, fascinating things like this. And yet we can't really get there without first getting people in the mindset of thinking right. And so that's what today is largely about. Setting the foundation to get into why is it that people often shut down when you're giving them new information? Why aren't people very good at grasping new things and running with it and making it part of their new mental bag of tricks rather than resisting it? Why don't we learn more than we do? And so here I am encroaching into the notes I previously wrote without reading them to you. I'm just going to read you a little bit of what I wrote. I want to talk about what keeps people from gaining more understanding about the Bible. It's a large book and people spend years around it, yet so few tend to become masters of the material. And often are those who do end up learning lots of it. They get a lot wrong while also being overconfident in their understanding and emotionally protective of it. Do you know what I'm talking about? Somebody who makes a Bible mistake, well, gee, that's not hard. We've all done that. Even if we don't know that we've done it, we've certainly done it. But the people who overinvest in protecting their ideas about the Bible, now maybe they think, hey, well, these ideas, they're like straight from God. So there's no need to question this or to rethink it. In fact, if you suggest I do, you are fighting God. Well, okay, there's a lot of that, and that's quite a defense. That's quite a suit of armor they have on there. And how do you get through that? Why is it so hard to correct people when they are wrong? Why is it that you can correct someone and they can repeat the answer back to you, the right answer, and even claim to agree with you on the correction? But then they go right back to their old habits. Next time you look, they're saying the old thing again as if they had never learned the new thing. Why is that? You can look to the Bible for answers to these things, and you'll likely come up with answers like foolishness or pride. You know, this is why people are not correctable. They're proud, or to use common church talk, they're prideful, which I always regretted that word every time I heard it in church. And the Bible can help us a lot with these things, but these are not the sort of granular explanations we might hope to find in the Bible. The fact of the matter, though, is that nowhere in the Bible did any writer sit down to write an exposition on cognitive errors, cognitive biases, the things that go into getting things wrong, and what is the psychology of man and how does it work? You just won't find that. And the reason I know you won't find it is I have looked and looked and looked. And I've read a great deal with these things in mind and have found bits and pieces that most certainly apply, but there is no exposition. There is no, you know, Philippians chapter 7 where Paul writes a 3-page exposition on human psychology and how people protect their errors of belief. Yet obviously, if you read Paul, just to give an example, if you read him at length, you'll find he's constantly correcting people's errors. Jesus did it also. He even anticipated people's errors. He says, like the place where he says, and do not think to yourself, you know, such and such, but think this instead. So he's already knowing how they think and going to anticipate the errors that they're going to make in response to whatever thing he's telling them. So the Bible is filled with this kind of thing, but it's more in narrative, here's what happened fashion, and not in expositional fashion. Like, okay, I'm going to tell you all about human psychology and especially the errors that they make in their thinking and how they protect those errors and protect themselves from self-correction. So what do we do? If that's not written out in the Bible, I'm going to read you a bit here from my notes. I think that as a society, we are generally not very good at dealing with our emotions. Now, why am I talking about emotions? Just pardon me for a second. I'm going to keep reading. The pleasant emotions are one thing, but the unpleasant ones often throw us for a loop, and our responses to them can be very counterproductive. If we don't know how to handle them well, we can end up doing some very foolish things in an attempt to avoid unpleasant emotions. And there's much to explore when it comes to that. Well, indeed there is. Now, why I'm talking about emotions is that there's a shutdown. When you try to talk to somebody and say, oh boy, what could it be? Your church's doctrine about... the teen ministry, having a teen ministry. And of course, there's no example of a teen ministry in the Bible. So you're already sort of outside the box, off the map, if you've got a teen ministry. And then the question, of course, becomes, well, is this okay? If it's okay, how is that okay? Were the churches meant to evolve over time, or were they supposed to stay like the original? Well, that's a whole big can of worms and a super important discussion. I don't mean to get down that trail, but when you bring up a challenge to anything or a question of anything, some questions are taken as challenges when they're not. They're just questions. So, and I'll tell you a story about that in a minute if I don't forget. There's an emotional response often from the person who's being challenged or questioned. So here's the story I wanted to tell you. I remember when I was a kid, I had an after-school babysitter who lived two blocks away, and her son was my best friend, and we'd hang out practically every day. And I remember once they went to some church or other, and somehow God came up in the conversation between the three of us one day, and I asked some question about it. And I don't remember the question, but it was an information-seeking question. Well, the two of them immediately looked aghast and said something like, oh, don't question God. And they seemed quite concerned. I'm like, my view of it now is, look, I'm a kid. I wonder about things. I have this question, so I voiced the question. And so what's the problem here? I'm not trying to attack God or to defy him or something. I just want to know something. But their response was very emotional. They suddenly, something I said triggered them into going into that mode. And of course, to me now, this is very concerning because, well, how are you two ever going to learn anything about God if you don't ask questions in your mind? That is, if you don't wonder things, if you don't have any curiosity, if you're not processing and turning it over in your head, well, if it says this about God, well, how would that work with regard to this other thing? And well, what's he like? Well, what would God think about this? These are all questions that I got the firm feeling were not acceptable in their minds. And I can only wonder what the outcome would be of sustaining that kind of protective, oh, don't go there kind of thinking. And so it was definitely an emotional thing that went on. There were a lot of feelings involved in it. Yet, had I asked them to explain... Of course, I was elementary school at the time. But had I been precocious and asked them to explain this, I doubt very much I would have gotten a well-reasoned response. It just would have been another protective, emotional, maybe even guard dog kind of, don't go there kind of response. And so what it was a shutting down And this, whatever the very simple topic was of that conversation, I wish I remembered, but they shut it down. If there's a word I'll borrow from cult studies, they talk about a thought stopper. And I don't think that my friends were saying, oh, let's be cultish and let's throw out a thought stopper here and get Jack redirected from his question. But that was the effect of what they did. It at least for that conversation, it shut down my thinking, and I did indeed quit with my questioning. I didn't press them. You know, your best friend and his mom, you don't do that. But, or at least I didn't do that. Maybe somebody else would. But so that's what I'm getting at. I think that this shutting down happens a great deal. I mentioned in the last episode, or perhaps number 13, about various doctrinal discussions when from time to time somebody will come to me and say, oh, I'm pretty sure you're wrong about this one, and I'm going to prove it and come back. And then they don't come back. Well, okay, what was it that shut down that conversation? Because it started as a conversation. Hey, I think you've got this wrong. Okay, says Jack. Well, I'm going to come back and prove it. Okay, says Jack. See you later. See you when you get back. And then they don't come back. Well, something happened to shut it down. In fact, how I know that is they're the ones who initiate it. And I love that they initiated. Don't get me wrong. I love the conversation, even though it might sting emotionally sometimes to be corrected, even if you're, whether the correction itself is right or wrong, still it can be emotionally hard. And actually, we're going to talk about that somewhat today. So this is why I was talking about the emotions, that I don't think in our culture we are well trained about that. And we'll talk some about what one cognitive scientist says about it. So, pardon me, I'm looking at my notes here. Oh, I was writing, I think we need a primer on what our emotions are and how they work. Because if we don't manage, especially the unpleasant emotions, well, you're going to find those in a doctrinal discussion. In a discussion about the Bible. Because if somebody's really thought through it a lot, and you're a typical American Christian who has not thought through it a lot, they're going to come up with information that you haven't processed for before. And when that happens, how are you going to feel? Well, you're going to feel, let me scroll down, you're going to feel something like sadness or shame or helplessness or anger or vulnerability. Or embarrassment, or disappointment, or frustration, or uncertainty, or confusion, or perhaps the fear of having your apple cart turned over, having your neat little package of beliefs rearranged somehow. These are the kinds of things that we will go through in our feelings anytime information is in dispute. It's just a natural thing. Well, to put it shortly, some people can get through that and others can't. Some have trained themselves or been trained by someone else to navigate these unpleasant feelings and still to process all the thinking and information, all the logic and sourcing, reasoning, all the facts. And others don't process that well. They just shut down. So you can still have the conversation but not learn anything from it. Maybe you even process the information during the conversation, but then you shut down later. You decide, well, I didn't really like that after all. So, surprise, you thought I was open to what you said, but no, I'm not. In retrospect, I'm closing myself down to that. And so this is what I think happens a lot. Even in the discussions we've had so far, I've had a lot of people I've initiated, hey, go listen to my COVID-19 episode, you may find this unique perspective to be helpful. Oh, okay, great. I'll go listen. And then there's no comment later, which is really sad because obviously I have put forth information that you probably never thought about before, never knew about. You never put these things together from the Bible before. So it's a fantastic conversation, a field of exploration. And yet you shut it down. and you're not even going to come back to me and say, you know, Jack, that was a lot of new information, so I just shut it down. Instead, that's the last I hear of it. Unless, you know, I were to go back and ask you, so, hey, did you listen to my podcast and what do you think? And so this is very disappointing because we could be having these great conversations where we could maybe learn some things. And again, even if I'm wrong on something and you know about it, you could tell me that and then I could learn. But instead, you shut me down and you shut you down too. You shut your own thinking down. So we're going to talk about that. Scrolling back up to find where I was. So first of all, again, I think we need a primer on what the emotions are and how they work, but we're not going to get that out of the Bible because nobody in the Bible wrote such a thing. So let's do establish, though, that the Bible does indeed make frequent mentions of emotions. You may well be aware of this already, but let me just pull up a few examples for the record. I searched in the ESV, searching all in one version for words just to see a little bit of what I'd get. And this is very abridged search, but you'll get the idea here. I searched the word happiness. I got two returns. I searched happy. I got eight returns throughout the Bible. Sadness got two. Sad got nine. Fear got 347. And afraid got 165. And we should definitely talk about why those two seem to be such the topic in the Bible. Grief got 16. Grieve, the verb, got 31. Grieved got 20. Gladness got 46. And I searched words like feelings and got nothing. Yet I searched terms like felt sure or felt compassion, felt certain, felt a godly grief. There are returns like that. So there is, I won't go any further with this, I'll bore you to death, but there is definitely a lot of talk about emotion in the Bible. It seems to me that the talk, if I were to characterize it, is unremarkable. That is, they seem to talk about emotions the same way that we experience them today. I can't tell that there's been any shift in the emotional lives of people from the ancient times to today. So you can either go like read the whole Bible or search a bunch of these terms yourself, or you can take my word for that. But I do hope you'll think it through and ponder that. So what are the emotions? When we feel these things, whether happy or sad or afraid or excited or delighted in something, humorous, laughing, you know, there's all these kinds of things. When we feel these, what is actually happening inside of us? Well, again, this is where it's going to get kind of scary for some, because some people think that it's not right to look outside the Bible for this kind of information. It's as if they have been taught that good information can only be found in the Bible, and if it's found elsewhere, it can't be good. But the Bible doesn't explain trees to us, and yet we as humans know quite a great deal about trees. They're deciduous and evergreen trees, and we know about osmosis and osmotic pressure, and we know why the leaves are different colors at different times. All these kinds of things we have learned. It's now part of the wisdom of the ages. Yet the Bible doesn't explain these things, although it mentions trees quite a lot. So what shall we do? Shall we not import any of our understanding from the natural world as we read the Bible? Is that the right way to manage that? Or we just resist every bit of information that we get from scientific observation, or even from our own casual observation in the backyard? Is that really the way to think? Well, if it were, it would be very helpful if one of the Bible authors had written that. But I know of no such passage. In fact, this brings up a story. I had a friend a couple of years ago who threw out in a discussion this axiom, and I forget exactly how he put it, but it said something along the lines of, we ought not teach what is not in the Bible. And so I wrote him back. I said, do you realize, dear friend, at least I doubt I said dear friend, but do you realize that this very thing you have just taught here, that is the statement, we ought not to teach what is not in the Bible, do you realize that that statement is itself not in the Bible? So haven't you just broke your own rule? Well, indeed he had. And we are, as a result, no longer friends on Facebook. So, okay, I guess he shut me down. Which is just another example of this kind of behavior, this self-protective behavior that won't let anybody under the hood of your brain or your mind to, tweak some things. Oh, no, we're not having this discussion, Jack. Yes, obviously, I was right that his little statement is not itself in the Bible, so he's breaking his own rule. But we're not having that talk. He decided to shut down from me, shield himself from me, to not take the correction, nor to explain to me why my correction was actually wrong in some way. And, of course, if it's wrong, I have not perceived how it's wrong in the couple of years of pondering that thing. Indeed, I have gone on to make quite a list of self-breaking rules that people tend to apply in life, and that is definitely on there. I think I have 14 or 15 by now that I have noticed. So again, that's another shutting down thing. And rather than to discuss it with me, it was just, okay, I'm done. We're not talking anymore. And who knows? People like this over the years, sometimes they'll call you a heretic. They'll say, oh, well, he's insane. Oh, he's from the devil. it's like, look, I just asked you a question. So I didn't know from my own reading of the Bible that Christianity was an anti-intellectual, non-examining kind of religion. I thought it was one where we could ask and learn and grow and correct ourselves and so forth. So why are so many people like this? Well, I don't purport to know everything about the answers, but a lot of it has to do with the emotions because they can't handle or have been taught not to handle when they get surprised, when somebody contradicts, when somebody questions, when somebody offers further information or a new nuance in their understanding even. They've been taught to shut that down. A lot of them have been taught to do that in the name of God, like this is the right thing to do. When somebody questions your understanding of the teen ministry, you are to shut them down and do not let them even question you. Like, okay, well, that's no good. You know, Jesus allowed people to question him, and Paul allowed people to question him, and Peter allowed people to question him. In fact, Peter got questioned by Paul on his behavior. How is it now part of Christianity that, no, we don't do that. We stick to our guns. Whatever you believe, that's like God approved, God sanctioned, and don't let anybody mess with your beliefs. And fortunately, not all believers in Jesus have that kind of habit, but a lot do, at least to some extent. I don't mean to overstate it. Some are like, they're going to totally shut you down mid-sentence, and others will hear you out, or at least partially hear you out for a time. And so I recognize people are all over the field with that. So are we going to say that, well, since it's not in the Bible, anything a scientist says about the human emotions must be wrong? Well, on what basis could we say that if we're being honest, rational, and responsible? Sure, you can shut out all challenges to you. After all, some scientists do say irresponsible things, irrational, dishonest things, even in their pursuit against God and religion. Some are atheists And, you know, the one who says there is no God is indeed being foolish, because logically speaking, how could you possibly prove that there is no God? That is unfalsifiable in logical terms. You have no means to prove this. So there's definitely some monkey business that goes on in the name of science, just like there is in the name of God and in the name of law and in the name of government and in the name of education and in the name of advertising and marketing. There is monkey business that goes on with people in every field of human endeavor. So are we going to say, oh, well, no, we can't discuss science because clearly that's like from the devil and it's all going to be wrong? Well, if that's the case, you probably have driven across a bridge designed by scientists and they didn't get the bridge wrong. And you probably drove it in a car designed by scientists and made possible by scientific discoveries, and they didn't get that wrong. And even this podcast, how could you listen to this without using the technology developed by scientists? Am I saying all scientists are right about everything they say? Absolutely not. That would be stupid. It would also be against the facts. There are a great many failures of science, famously on the record, all kinds of like medical things that ended up killing people, other innovations, like how about this one I learned from my seventh grade geography teacher. How about the advent of gas lighting in houses? People were used to candles and lanterns. At the end of the day, when you're ready to go to sleep, you blow out the lantern. Well, now here's the new gas light. Rather than turn off the valve, people would blow them out, and they would wake up dead the next morning from asphyxia, from the gas killing them. And so, well, there's a scientific, technological improvement that kills people. And there's tons and tons of examples, and I'd love to have a fantastic list of those, because science for many becomes like an unquestioned religion where they say, oh, science says that it must be true. Well, that's really stupid. The same as saying, oh, the preacher says that it must be true. In fact, the new preacher you get next year might not say that thing anymore. And how are you going to handle that? So these things require thinking and not shutting down. Okay. So now we need to talk about what the emotions are. Well, this deals with something called theory of mind, which is really quite a simple concept. It's just, okay, what is the human mind? How do we know? How do we think it's arranged? And I don't mean to delve too deep into all this. I certainly myself, for example, am not an expert on the physiology of the brain. I have not studied that very much, except as incidental to my readings about the psychology of rational thinking. However, I can tell you that generally scientists view the mind as a thing that takes place in the brain, but is not specifically centered in any one particular place. So talk about the mind is more theoretical in nature. Although they can say, oh, he's thinking about such and such in the fMRI machine, and we see that the brain is lighting up over here in this area when he's thinking about, I don't know, the math question, or when he looks at a picture of his mom, this other area lights up. Okay, so there's some of that going on. But more theoretically is the idea of mind, and there has been an evolution of how people explain what the human mind is or how it functions, how it seems to be arranged or organized, and that's called theory of mind, and not everybody agrees. Today, there is a standard model that has the mind in two parts, a system one and a system two, and this is largely the work championed most by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. Kahneman is the author of the fairly newish and very popular book, Thinking Fast and Slow, And I've put a link to that at Amazon in the show notes for this episode. And he has this two-part model of the mind, which they call, scientifically, they call it System 1 and System 2, or informally, he calls it the slow system and the fast system. So System 1 is the slow stuff. I'm sorry, the fast stuff. And System 2 is the slow stuff. So I'm going to explain that in a minute. But I want to move on to mention Keith Stanovich, who has done a lot of work with rationality. And he has a three-part model, or a tripartite model of the mind, in which case there is this System 1 and System 2-ish, or Type 1 thinking and Type 2 thinking. But he also has a third type, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But the first two types, let me give you the Stanovich names for those. One is the autonomous mind. That's what Kahneman would call the fast mind, or System 1. And then there's the algorithmic mind. So just those two words are helpful in explaining these ideas. And I want to see, as we talk through this, whether you find these things familiar in your own experience. If you're like me, you will say, oh yeah, okay, well I go through this. Oh yeah, that happens when I'm thinking. Sure, I get this, I get that. So these names sort of make sense for these things. So the autonomous stuff, that's what the word, you know, autonomous, autonomy, automatic, these are things that happen automatically in your mind. For example, you're driving your car, you see a stop sign. Well, you know what that is. You know immediately from your memory, not only that, okay, that's a stop sign, it's red, it's octagonal, probably has the white outline, it's got the word stop in white letters. You know it before you could possibly read, you know, process the language on it and read it. You know what that is and what it means, and chances are, if you're the driver, your foot has already started moving toward the brake pedal before you've ever processed any language. Language is slower. Language is not the kind of thing that happens in those most immediate few nanoseconds after an event. So here you see the stop sign, you know what it is, and you have trained your body to reach for the brake pedal or to get ready to reach for the brake pedal. You already know this without having to get out your abacus or your calculator or your slide rule, or to count anything on your fingers, or to formulate any language, to write an essay, to call your friends, to post on Facebook. You just know it immediately. It's the same thing with the joke squirrel, right? About a person with ADD who's constantly distracted by things, and you see the squirrel immediately, you know it's a squirrel. If you see a bear, immediately you go into fight or flight mode. You decide to run or not, or whatever you're going to do. You immediately feel the sensation of alert and fear and whatever other words should best describe that. These are automatic things. You've been trained, conditioned cognitively and emotionally, that your mind immediately turns on these certain awarenesses, these certain emotional states in response to things that you see or hear or read. Some sort of stimulus happens and your brain automatically goes into this mode. That's the autonomous stuff, and it happens very fast, and it seems to be by design. In fact, this is a very, very good thing. Then there's the algorithmic side, or what Kahneman would call the slow thinking. The algorithmic, that's you with the pencil figuring out the math problem, or it's you figuring out the guest list, or where should they all sit and why? Or what should go on the menu for the party? Or how many places need to be set? Or do we use the fancy dessert forks or just go with a fork, knife, and spoon like we do every day? All right, these kinds of questions, these are things that have to be settled. They have to be decided upon. And this is extremely slow compared to the immediate System 1 autonomous functions of the mind. So I hope this is making sense so far. There are things we do that are deliberately done, and there are things that automatically just come up. And so this is very important to know. And both systems are very, very needful. For example, suppose you're going to buy a car and you're talking with the salesman and you just get a funny feeling about the salesman and you don't know how to sort it all out yet, but something just doesn't seem right to you. This is an emotional thing. You're not sure what to make of this. And so you're smart enough to say, well, all right, thanks for the information. I'm going to go now and think about this, and then we'll revisit it perhaps tomorrow. Thanks, goodbye. And then you leave. You may figure out on your drive home, oh, I know what triggered me. When he said such and such, that seemed like a crooked deal, or it didn't seem like the right wording. And I got concerned I was going to get snookered somehow by the guy. And so you can figure it out later, perhaps. Maybe you never put your finger on why you felt funny about the guy, but chances are you will do that. And so this takes a while for it to develop. Well, the immediate feeling of apprehension about the guy was super useful. Something about your system was, dare I use the word, smarter than the rest of your systems were. You know, you weren't standing there thinking with the guy, oh, that's wrong what he said, and the reason it's wrong is A, B, C, and D. You hadn't done all that calculation, and yet you have an emotional sense that comes up very quickly that something's not right here. Hope I'm making sense so far. So meanwhile, you may also have emotional senses that are wrong. You may have met, for example, say you're at church one day and there's a visitor there you haven't met before. And so you decide to introduce yourself and you say, hey, I'm Jack. And he says, oh, my name's Frank. Oh, Frank, what do you do for a living? Oh, I sell used cars. Well, suppose that just with that, I had this emotional twinge of apprehension about Frank, the used car salesman, based on other experiences I've had with used car salesmen who were slimy and greasy and you know, unscrupulous. Suppose that my emotions about Frank were the same as those, and so I shut down and walk away from Frank. Well, Frank is a used car salesman. He can't be honest. He's trouble. Stay away from Frank. Well, what if Frank's not like other used car salesmen? In that case, my emotions would have led me astray, right? And I would need to think it through and tell myself, wait a minute, Jack, you don't know if Frank is bad news or not. As far as you know, he's quit 3 dealerships already because they're unscrupulous and he's not. And so you owe it to Frank and to yourself and to God and to reality and truth and justice and the American way. You owe it to all these things to go and get to know Frank for who he really is and find out for real what's he like, because maybe he doesn't fit the stereotype that your emotions flagged you with as soon as he told you he was a used car dealer. If you were sitting in the room with me, I'd be looking for understanding in your eyes. I would say, does this make sense? And then hopefully you would nod and say yes, or shake your head and say no. But here we are just on a podcast, so I am set adrift without being able to see whether I'm getting through to you. I hope this is clear. So this idea that you can have these extended thinking, the deliberate thoughts that we often put into language in our heads, that's the algorithmic, that's the figuring stuff out mode. But the autonomous mode, or the system one, the type one thinking, that's the fast stuff. And you don't really have any immediate control over that. It is autonomous. It is automatic. And so the main thing we need to know is that those automatic feelings are sometimes dead on right, and sometimes they are absolutely wrong. So how are you going to handle that? Well, you can either just go with that and sometimes be right and sometimes be wrong, and that's the end of it. Or you can learn how to use the algorithmic mind. you can learn how to think through a thing and decide whether the fast feelings were right or not, or how right they were. Maybe they're partially right. Yeah, I felt funny about that thing the guy said, but then I realized there was a little bit funny to it, but the rest of what he's saying was pretty straightforward and honest. So, you know, it can be sometimes there's reason to feel funny, but not to completely dismiss. So, okay. So now this is a difficult talk to have while not looking at a person looking back. Okay, so you've got the immediate fast emotions. You've got the thinking, the deliberate working out of things, processing things in your mind. Which one is easier? Well, if somebody hits you with a little rubber hammer on the knee and the knee jerks, that's a knee-jerk reaction. And that is very easy because you had to do nothing to make that happen. It is automatic. Yet if the doctor says, hey, I just hit your knee with the rubber hammer and it kicked out, I'm going to give you some homework. Come back to me next week with an essay about why that happened. Oh boy, now you've got some work to do. You've got to think through it. You've got to research it. You've got to do some writing. You've got to edit your writing and be sure it's clear and concise. You've got to fact check things and so forth. Which one's easier? To have that knee kick out there through automatic reflex response, or to write an essay about what all happened at the doctor's office? Well, duh, the second one takes lots of work. Well, welcome to reality. You were created into a world where work is required. Some people don't know that in this world, if you step off a cliff, that is not going to end well for you. But then some people are infants and have not yet been taught about this. Some people don't know that if you step off into the pool, not knowing how to swim, you may drown. But then some people are infants and toddlers and haven't yet been taught about this. Do you understand what I'm saying? That we must learn certain things here in order to survive well in this world. Oh, don't eat that mushroom. You can eat this one, but not that one. Well, who's going to teach you that? You're not, well, if you figure this out yourself, you may figure it out the hard way. Maybe you get sick and not die, but somebody has to teach you things, and there's work required, and not only physical work. Indeed, we have to work to eat. Even if somebody brings you the food, are they going to put it in your mouth and chew it for you? No, there's work involved in your eating. There's work involved in deciding what to eat or not. You can decide, no, I'm not going to work on that. I will eat whatever I feel the urge to eat. And so if I have a desire for it, I'll eat it. End of story. No more thinking. No more analysis. No more examination of the outcome of that kind of eating. Well, how healthy are you going to be once you get addicted to sugars, for example? You're going to get very sick eventually. Your body will eventually have had enough of that and start shutting down in various ways. So we're put into this world where we have to think if we're going to do well. And we have to do other work, clean ourselves, dress ourselves, eat, gather food, do the work to earn the money to pay for food, and so forth and so on. This is a working place. Well, what if Billy doesn't like to work? And Billy doesn't like to do any thinking work either. And so he just feels what he feels. He makes his decisions on the spot based on how he feels about meeting Frank at church. Ah, used car salesman, that Frank. Can't trust that guy. They're all the same, right? Well, Billy, that's what we call foolish. But if Billy decides, well, he's not interested in thinking, not interested in knowing the truth about Frank, well, Billy is going to be foolish, and that's what Billy's like. And now we all have to enjoy the world with Billy in it. Thanks, Billy. Yet there are millions and probably billions of people somewhat like that, maybe a lot like that, maybe a little bit like that sometimes. And so this is a danger we all run. Cognitive scientists have a term for us explaining how we don't like to crank up the algorithmic mind. And that term is cognitive miser. Just like a normal miser refuses to spend a dime if he's not forced to spend it, the cognitive miser refuses to spend any effort on thinking unless he's forced to do it. It is this general built-in reluctance, or at least the disposition that may be conditioned and trained in us by our own habits, to avoid the algorithmic thinking, the intentional, deliberate thinking, the stuff that takes time and takes effort. Well, many people live at this very low level of, I just don't do any of that. Some people do it as needed. They'll do it in school when they have to write the essay, but they're so not going to do it outside of class, the same kind of deep thinking it took to write an essay for the English class. They're not going to do that kind of thinking to examine their own beliefs or the way the student council rules have the meetings run. They're never going to think through that and think whether this should be better or not, unless it feels to them like, well, that's just wrong. We need to change this, which may or may not be a good course of action. They're not going to think through it, mind you. So the cognitive miser, this is a term that I find very, very useful. And let me mention here also that it has a mate, the moral miser, where the cognitive miser doesn't want to expend the effort to think through a thing. The moral miser doesn't want to expend the effort to take the high road morally. So, go ahead and steal it. It's only $5, right? Notice the quote justification, which doesn't really justify it. That's why I put it in air quotes. Same thing with rationalizing. That word is almost always abused. Because people who are, quote, rationalizing aren't really thinking through reality. They are cheating in their minds in order to, quote, justify something that they know they ought not to do. So we have a cognitive miser and a moral miser. And often it's the same kind of thing. It's the reluctance to get with the program in this real world where work is required, whether it's mental work or physical work. And so again, I hope you're seeing ties back to God created man upright, but he has sought out many schemes. And I hope you're seeing ties to the whole conversation we just had about the fool and foolishness, because I think this is definitely tied in. In other words, God puts you here with a thinker in your head, with the brain, with the mind, and yet if you're like most, you have not developed that to its natural robustness. You have tended not to use it, at least on some topics. And when you're presented with new information, with the new topic, when somebody challenges or just questions you, you feel the wave of fatigue and dread over having to crank up this machine and think a thing through. And besides that, well, what if you're not good at that? Or what if you're not good at discussing things with people? Or what if you don't like the guy who just questioned you? Well, now there's the whole issue of your feelings for the person coming up, and that complicates the whole matter of whatever the intellectual matter was, the question that was put to you. So it gets really taxing for the cognitive moral miser to be questioned. And they would much rather shut you down or have you go away, or both. And this is why they will avoid, this is why they will throw you under the bus somehow. Oh, well, he's a heretic, or, well, I don't like his tone, or, nah, that guy's just a nut, or he just loves to argue, right? As if the argument itself had no content, no validity whatsoever. It's just for the joy of arguing, all these kinds of silly cheats we do to shut other people down. And we need to talk about this a lot. But so I wanted you to understand your emotions today. So let's talk about changing emotions, because I think you'll be able to relate to this. They are changeable. Some people say things like, oh, I've got to be true to what I feel. I don't feel good about the church's plan to do ABC. I just don't feel right about it. And I've got to be true to what I feel, so I vote no on the proposition. Well, okay, so your feelings then are the standard for your judgment in the matter of how the church should carry on matters A, B, and C. Is that the best you can do? And what makes you so certain that your feelings are indeed the best standard for making these judgments? So I want to talk about how feelings can be changed in a very good and rightful way and needed way, or needful, as we'd say archaically in American English. Imagine Sally. Sally is 4 years old, and Sally goes to a birthday party she's been invited to, and it's at the city park, and she and her mom get there. And they get out of the car, and they start to walk quickly across the lawn, and then Sally stops in her tracks. 100 yards away where the party is, she sees that the kids there are playing with a dog, and it's a big golden retriever. And Sally, a few months before, had been knocked down by an overly enthusiastic dog, and it hurt her, and it scared her a lot. And the dog was all licking her face and such. And Sally was screaming and crying, and her feelings were hurt. And maybe she's a little bruised from being knocked down. Maybe she got a scratch. And so this was a bad experience for her. And her mother panicked when this happened. Oh my, Sally, are you okay? Are you okay? And she really fed into the whole thing and didn't do anything to help Sally understand about the dog who had knocked her down. And so now here is Sally a few months later at another party, and she sees the big dog playing with the kids, and she's immediately scared. She stops dead in her tracks, and she is about to cry if she's not crying already. And the mother says, "What is it?" She says, "Oh, a dog. I can't go there. I'm scared." Okay, so here she has feelings that are well-founded in general, because she has, and these are immediate feelings, they immediately came up on seeing the dog because they are autonomous. And yet the mother tries to talk her into it, and then another parent comes by and asks what's happening, and they explain that, well, Sally's scared of the dog. And then the other parent, who's a little better at this than Sally's mom, she says, "Oh, I see. You have been scared by a dog in the past and hurt by one. Well, this dog is different. I want you to watch. Let's just stand here and watch, because these kids are playing with this dog. And this dog is very gentle with the kids. And have you noticed since you got there that none of them have been knocked down?" And Sally, of course, would say, "Yeah, that's right. None of them have been knocked down." Well, this may take a while, for it depends on how well Sally has been trained in decoupling from her feelings in order to think a thing through also, rather than to shut down. But in time, Sally can overcome these feelings at this very day, at this very party. And by the end of the party, she's with all the other kids playing with the dog, and she loves the dog and wants to have one just like that when she gets home. So how did this change? Well, it did not change from Sally shutting down. For example, had Sally gotten out of the car, walks toward the playground area where the party is, sees the dog, stops dead in her tracks, throws a tantrum at the idea, at the mother's idea of moving forward, and they end up just going back home, and that's it, end of story, no dog. If there's a dog, I'm not going. I don't do dogs. Well, that would be shutting down. That would be altering the whole rest of her life in order to coddle this fear that was conditioned from one bad experience. But if she doesn't shut down, if she keeps going, then Sally has a chance to learn something about the world. Ah, not all dogs are the same. And boy, wouldn't we do good with this one to learn it across the board. Ah, not all whites are the same. Not all blacks are the same. Not all Hispanics are the same. Not all men are the same. Not all women are the same. Wouldn't it be good if we could learn lessons like that? Yes, a person of this color hurt me in the past, but this does not mean that all people of that color are the same. Or a person of that sex hurt me in the past, but it doesn't mean that all people of that sex are the same. Look at what a popular error that is. But if we never learn to decouple from our negative feelings and realize, okay, what, this is how I'm feeling scared or I'm feeling suspicious of this person. Okay, but let me think it through. If we use only the fast thinking, which is not really thinking at all, it's the emotional awareness that comes to mind. If we use only that and don't use our algorithmic minds to think through a situation, we're going to make bad decisions very often. Sometimes they'll be good decisions. Sally gets out of the park. There's a dog. Oh my, a dog. I'm so scared. Well, it turns out this dog too is undisciplined or, cannot curb its enthusiasm, and it would push her down too, knock her down, or maybe if it's even a mean dog and it would bite her, it could be that she gets it right once in a while, and it's just like that old saying, even a blind hog can root up an acorn from time to time, or even a broken clock is right twice a day, right? Okay, so sometimes your feelings will be right about a thing of this nature, but not all Italians are thieves. In the movies we watch, many of the Italians are thieves, but not all Italians are thieves, and you can count on that. You can decide, well, I'm going to stay biased like this the rest of my life and just maintain these bad feelings, suspicious feelings about all Italians because, hey, I've seen the movies. But you're going to be predictably wrong in a lot of cases, even if you are right from time to time about some particular Italian who turns out to be a thief, just as you, quote, knew, end quote, they would be. So I hope I'm making sense to you about how the emotional awareness that immediately comes up may or may not be right for the situation we're in. Of course, if Sally were to go to lots of birthday parties and see lots of dogs, she would eventually become more sophisticated in her thinking, and she would realize, okay, wait a minute, there's a dog, and yes, I feel a little alarmed, but let's see, let's watch for a minute and see what kind of dog it is. And I don't mean the breed necessarily, but what kind of behavior does this dog have? Is it jumping up on the kids or not? Is it licking them in the face, or is it disciplined and doesn't do that? Are the other kids scared of it? Is there a reason for me to be scared of this? You know, let's observe, let's really process this. That's algorithmic thinking. So if Sally can learn to do that, then she can live a life where she avoids some dogs with very good reason, and other dogs she learns to enjoy a great deal and even ends up getting one at home to enjoy every day. See the difference in the life between that Sally and the Sally who cannot decouple from the feeling, who throws a tantrum and has to get back in the car and be taken home. She's unconsolable. She is unwilling to face the fear of any dog situation whatsoever for the rest of her life. So we're really talking about someone being, I suppose the word crippled could be useful here, being crippled by a decision that, no, I will not process this. There cannot possibly be any good dog in the whole world. And I know this because of the one bad dog that knocked me down. This obviously is not good logic. But hey, this is how it works. Some of you will find this very, very simple. Some of you will find this and boring because it's so simple. But a lot of people really need to know this. You don't know that your feelings can be reprogrammed, reconditioned, retrained is probably even a better word. You can do this. And this happens all the time. Have you ever watched a TV show that you didn't like, but then it grew on you? When Star Trek Voyager came out in whatever century that was, I did not like Captain Janeway. And then a few episodes later, I actually liked her quite a lot. Well, my emotional response to her changed. Why is that? Oh, I don't know, but it did. And so I think you'll be able to relate to this. You can understand, yes, your emotions about various things change. Some people, even with romance, it's love at first sight, and then 2 weeks later, they hated each other. Or they did not like each other up front, but they ended up getting married. That was my parents. They didn't hit it off well up front, but then they ended up married for many, many decades. So I think we should all be able to understand this. So I'm going to break into the conversation here. We're going to split this one in half. It turned out to be just slightly over 2 hours in length. And so we'll cut down where each half is just over an hour. This is going someplace. We're going to end up this conversation in episode 16 with talk about the core doctrine concept and how that sometimes serves to shut down conversation that people aren't quite sure how to keep having. And so I hope you're enjoying this. There'll be more of it. We'll finish it out, so it should make more sense by the time you've finished episode number 16. And that's it for this one. Thanks for joining in.